Pray. Father, thanks for all that's already happened in our service this morning, and we thank you that in a few minutes we'll get to celebrate communion, sing another song together. I pray, Lord, that in the meantime you would help us to focus in on your word, that you would be open in our hearts and our minds to hear what it is that you're saying to us through your word. Help us to correctly understand it and apply it to our lives. And I pray for everyone in this room, from young to old, that you'd help them to stay tuned in to what it is you're communicating to us this morning. So I pray especially for the young folks, Lord, as they have to sit for a while and listen. I pray you'd be working in their hearts and their minds, help them to understand, that you'd be drawing them to you and building them as little followers of you. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, when Kalen was 4 years old, almost 5 years old, he was outside playing in our neighborhood, and he knew the rules, and he was following the rules. He was doing the right thing. He was out playing, and he saw that a car was coming, and he knew that he's supposed to go to the sidewalk, not be in a driveway, not be in the road, just be on the sidewalk and wait. And so he's standing there as a little four-year-old doing his thing, and there's a lady coming into the neighborhood looking for the house that she's going to, not sure where she's going. And she pulls into the driveway right where Caleb is. She doesn't see him. She cuts the corner too tightly and runs over Caleb twice. His legs get pulled down under the front wheels. The skin gets ripped off of his legs. His foot gets broken in a couple places. And then she continues forward and runs over him with the second set of wheels, not knowing that he's there at all until she opens the door and there's a bleeding, screaming kid on the ground. It was a traumatic moment. Now, Caleb, because his leg was so swollen and all the skin was gone, he couldn't be casted for a while because he needed to be cast, but he couldn't, and so we had to like change the dressings a couple times a day because it was seeping all this oozy, nasty stuff. It was really hard to get him as a four-year-old to sit still for a few weeks. Maybe you as a parent have had a similar situation where you've got a young person, maybe they're injured, maybe they're sick, maybe there's something mysterious going on with them. You don't know what it is. Maybe the doctors can't explain it. Maybe you've spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours and traveled all over the place, and there's just no answer. You don't know what to do. Everybody kind of shrugs their shoulders, lifts up their hands and says, "I'm sorry, we have no idea what else to do." Maybe you know that desperate feeling, that helpless feeling, that panicked feeling, like, God, is there a solution, or is this just how it's going to be? We're going to look at a passage in the book of Mark today where a father is dealing with that very situation with his son. And we're going to look at how Jesus interjects into that situation. We're going to look at how his disciples first tried to help the situation, but it didn't work. They failed. And we're going to look at just the amazing way that God meets this family in their hour of need and provides for them, and in the process gives us a lesson or two. So if you're joining us for the first time or haven't been here in a while, we've been working our way through the Gospel of Mark. There are four gospel books in the New Testament. These are the stories of Jesus' life written from four different perspectives, that of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Of those four, Mark is the shortest by far and the fastest paced. In general, he leaves out a lot of details. Either he doesn't include the story at all, and maybe Matthew includes it or Luke includes it, or he just shortens it, condenses it really small, and goes on to the next thing. Today's passage is the exception. You'll find today's passage in Mark and in Matthew, and I think in Luke also. And in Matthew and Luke, they're very short, but Mark expands it and gives us the details of what's going on. So for some reason, Mark completely changes his way of operating for this particular story. Maybe he was particularly touched. Maybe the Holy Spirit was moving in him in a certain way when he was writing this, but Mark thought, the people need to know the details. So he went for it. So we've been going through Mark, and I don't think I explained this before, so this might be helpful to you guys. Mark is divided into a few sections. Let's go to the next slide, Russell. So chapters 1 through 8 is the public ministry of Jesus. Mark completely skips the whole birth thing in Bethlehem and all that. He just skips. He goes right into Jesus preaching and teaching. And for 8 chapters, it's the public ministry. Crowds, traveling, new people all the time coming to him. All right, and then for 9 and 10, is that my mic squealing like that? Okay, For 9 and 10, there's a transition time where he's training just his closest disciples. We call them the 12 disciples or the 12 apostles. And he tries to retreat from the crowds, give them special lessons, basically preparing them for when he's going to be gone, and they take over the ministry. So he's trying to teach them how to lead people. And then the rest of the book of Mark, 11 through 16, is devoted to just the last week of Jesus' life. So you've got 1 through 10 devoted to 3 whole years, and then 11 through 16 devoted to 1 week. And that's the pattern for all 4 of the Gospels. A fair amount of information about the life of Jesus, in the case of Luke and Matthew, even about the birth and childhood of Jesus. But they all spend the largest chunk of time talking about the death and the resurrection of Jesus in the last week, because that is the reason he came. Yes, he did lots of teaching. He did lots of miracles. He was an amazing, amazing guy. But the main thing that he came for was to die on behalf of you and I, and then to rise again, conquering death and the grave. So right now we're in this transition time. We're in chapter 9, and Jesus is trying to spend some time with just his closest guys. Last couple weeks we looked at how he went up onto a mountain, and he was transfigured. He started glowing. You know, his clothes are glowing. His face is glowing. It's like God reached down and just pulled back the veil that had been hiding some of the true identity of Jesus. And Jesus had only taken with him the 3 top guys, Peter, James, and John. These 3 guys got to go up on the mountain. They were there as Jesus starts glowing. They were there as the cloud descends. They were there as somehow Moses, who'd been dead for 1,200 years, and Elijah, who'd been dead for 900 years, show up, have a conversation with Jesus, and then they're there when they hear the voice of God the Father speak from the cloud and say, this one right here, he is my son. Listen to what he has to say. And they fall on their faces trembling, and when they finally open their eyes after Jesus touches them and says, it's okay, guys, I'm here, they see that Moses and Elijah are gone. Jesus is the only one left, and they know that this voice from the cloud has singled out Jesus as the one that they're supposed to listen to. So that has just happened, and now they're making their way down the mountain, and that's where we pick up our story today. So if you're reading along, we're in Mark chapter 9. Mark 9, 14. And when they, that's Jesus, Peter, James, and John, came to the disciples, or the other 9 that were waiting at the base of the mountain, they saw a great crowd around them, and the scribes, those are the religious leaders, arguing with them. Now, sometimes the religious leaders had the courage to directly confront Jesus, but most of the time they went around the back and they got to Jesus' disciples when Jesus was paying attention to something else. Because they didn't want to fight the main guy, they just wanted to fight the supporters of the guy. Verse 15, and immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him, and he asked them, what are you arguing about with them? Now, for us, it's kind of hard to picture this, but luckily, 500 years ago, a painter named Raphael painted his last great painting and called it The Transfiguration, and it depicts this. So let's look at the painting here. This is it, and we'll zoom into some sections in just a minute, but get an idea of the whole big picture here, what's going on. This hangs in the Vatican in Rome, and it's a beautiful, amazing painting. I'm sure none of us in this room could even come close to this, but there's some weird things about it. So as we look at this, what do you guys notice that might be surprising to you? Anybody? What's going on in this picture? If you see something you want to shout it out, just go for it. What was that? See? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so we got the stuff going on the top of the mountain, but there's a lot more people there, right? Not only do we have the 2 scenes mashed together, we got the down at the bottom of the mountain scene going on at the same time as the up on the top of the mountain scene, but you've got Jesus, who of course is floating and glowing and doing all that, that he does in paintings. Then you've got Moses and Elijah. Then you've got Peter, James, and John on the ground. But if we zoom in to just the top half, we'll see there's other two guys over on the left-hand side looking on. What are these guys? They're not in the Bible account. What is Raphael thinking as he's doing that? So then if we look at the bottom half of the picture, what have we got going on here? We've got what look like some angry guys on the left, pointing their fingers, shouting. And then over on the right, in the green, we've got a father holding the son. And if we zoom in closer, we'll see a couple things about the son. First of all, Raphael's trying to, with the eyes, he's trying to depict the idea that this boy is somehow possessed by an evil spirit. The first thing I noticed when I zoomed in on this guy is that this boy has some serious arms. I mean, what is he doing with his free time that he's got arms like that? But, I mean, we're guessing he's like 10 years old or something, but I wouldn't want to arm wrestle this kid. So, but the father's holding the kid, and the kid, he's not attached to reality. He's kind of spaced out. Raphael's trying to show us that there's something wrong. He's oppressed here. And so he takes and puts into this painting both the mountaintop experience and the valley experience. And this is pretty cool, in my opinion, because what we see is, for the rest of 9 and 10, Jesus is trying to trying to train the disciples in how to live in the valley, because they're going to spend more time in the valley than they are up on the mountaintop. And that's true of us too. Maybe you've had a mountaintop experience with God. You know, for our six high schoolers that were standing up here, this last week was kind of a mountaintop experience. They got to get away from regular life. They got to focus in on God. They got to sing their hearts out and worship, learn some great stuff, make some new friends. And now they kind of come back into regular life, and it feels like they've come down into the valley. Maybe you've experienced that kind of thing. For Peter, James, and John, who are up there with Jesus, they just experienced the most amazing thing in their life. And they come down to an arguing, angry crowd and a possessed boy, and everything is in chaos. So let's go on and see what else he has to say here. Verse 17. Someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute." So we know that the boy can't talk. We find out later that he can't hear either. "And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth, and he becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." Now, when we look at this from our 21st century scientific medical world, we say, obviously, this is an epileptic boy, right? But they're looking at it, and they're saying, no, this is caused by a demon, by an evil spirit. Now, before you dismiss that idea, before you say, I'm too educated for that, notice that in the rest of the story, Jesus does not treat this like a physical condition. He treats this like a spiritual condition. The Bible does this over and over again. Sometimes people are sick. Sometimes people are oppressed by evil. The Bible says that both of those are very real. And in this case, we're seeing that it's the spiritual realm that's real. This book is written by the God of the universe, who created all the order that makes science possible. But he's also able to operate outside of that order. He can miraculously intervene at any point, and there is a hidden reality that we can't measure with scientific stuff. So, if you take this book seriously, I'd encourage you to take this story for the way it's written at face value. So imagine the scene. The father is desperate. He fully believes that his child is oppressed by an evil spirit, has been for a long time, has these epileptic seizures, and we're going to find out in just a minute that they're really pretty terrible. He's brought the child, hoping to find the traveling miracle worker, Jesus, but Jesus is on a mini vacation up on top of the mountain with Moses and Elijah, and so he goes to the disciples. The disciples try to cast the demon out, and they fail. And this is a total surprise to them because, as we read in Mark chapter 6, just three chapters earlier, Jesus had given authority to these very disciples, sent them out saying, go to the villages and cast out the demons from the oppressed people. They'd done this before. They'd seen it work. They had come back amazed. They said, Jesus, this is amazing. Even the demons obey us. And Jesus says, well, yes, that's the point. I gave you the authority. You're exercising it. That's how it's supposed to work, right? But this time it didn't work. And I'm sure chaos just followed. Like, maybe because Peter, James, and John are the big three, who knows? Maybe Matthew, maybe Andrew, maybe, we don't know. Somebody stood up and did the demon casting out thing. We don't know what that looked like. We don't know. But he got done, and the boy is no better. Maybe he's even worse. Maybe he's writhing on the ground. And then panic and desperation sets in. And now there's this big argument, and Jesus walks into the middle of it. So the father says, your disciples were not able to help. Verse 19, and he answered them, O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long do I have to put up with you guys? Right? And the answer is, not much longer. How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me. And they brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him, that is, saw Jesus, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground, and he rolled about, foaming at the mouth. When Jesus says, oh, you faithless generation, there are a few people that he could be speaking to. Maybe he's speaking to the general crowd that is gathered around. Okay? Maybe he's speaking to the father. Maybe he's speaking to the boy. Maybe he's speaking to the religious leaders who are accusing them and making the argument. Maybe he's speaking to the disciples. Maybe he's just speaking to everybody in the whole world, calling us all basically a faithless generation. I think that in this particular case, he's mostly pointing his finger at the disciples. Some would say, well, it's obvious that the father just didn't have enough faith, or the disciples with the power of Jesus would have been able to heal the boy, right? But look at how we go on through the rest of this conversation, how Jesus lays it at the feet of the disciples instead. Jesus asked his father, how long has this been happening to him? So he kind of ignores the fact that the boy is writhing on the ground, foaming at the mouth, and he starts a conversation with the father. How long has this been happening? He says, from childhood. It has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. So we know this has been going on for years. We know that this evil spirit is bent on trying to destroy the boy. Okay? That is the role of Satan and his demons. They come to kill, steal, and destroy. Those are the words of Jesus. That's what's going on here. And this particular boy has suffered greatly, where multiple times the seizures have cast him into the fire. So he's probably got scars all over him from being thrown into the open fire. He's been thrown into the water. How many times has somebody had to jump in and save the boy from drowning when a seizure induced by a demon has thrown him into the water? Think of the stress over the years that this family has been through. How many times have they had to save the life of this young boy? And so the father, at the end, he says, but if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Now, it's really easy for us sitting here today to think he's got to be the faithless one, because he says, if you can do anything, right? He's hedging his prayer there. And all of us, we do this. We want something from God, and we say, God, if you could just show up in this situation and help me out, I would really appreciate it. If you could take care of this, if you could please, and of course he can. He's all powerful. He can do whatever he wants. But we, because we're afraid of a no, or because we're afraid of maybe being ignored, we're afraid of not being answered, we're afraid of all kinds of things, we hedge our bets when we talk to God. Now, that doesn't mean you should go to the other extreme and start demanding things from God. You're going to do this. You're going to show up right now. And I'm showing you I've got enough faith that you have to honor what I'm doing. No, that is the other end of the spectrum. That is even more wrong. Right? But somewhere in the middle there is this idea of trusting God, but also trusting him with the timeline, trusting him that he will play things out in his will. And so if you're looking for a way to make a request to God that somehow honors him, his sovereignty, at the same time, I'd encourage you to pray something along the lines of, God, if it's your will, then please do this. Please intervene in this way. Now, you can use that as a faithless hedge also, but you can use it as a way of submitting yourself to the sovereignty of God, still presenting your request to him like he asked you to, but not doing it in a demanding way or in a faithless way. So the little boy, or the father says, if you can do this, have compassion on us and help us. And Jesus' response at first seems harsh. Jesus said to him, if I can, do you know who you're talking to? But it makes sense that the guy would doubt. He's heard about Jesus. He's heard about the followers of Jesus who seem to be able to do the same things as Jesus, but it didn't work. So if it didn't work for the followers, maybe it won't work for him either. And it makes sense that he says, if I can. But he follows it up with this. All things are possible for one who believes. This doesn't mean you can say, I believe that I am going to be rich, or I believe that I'm going to be president, or I believe that, you know, fill in the blank, whatever, and then you'll get it. That's not what Jesus is saying here. When he says all things are possible for him who believes, he's not talking about a magic genie in the bottle that if you say the right words and you put I believe in front of it, then you get whatever you want. That's not what he's saying. So what is he saying? I think he's talking about a relationship of dependence. I think the disciples, with their successful track record in other locations, see the guy coming and they think, I got this. High five each other. Andrew takes over. He says the stuff expecting the demon to flee, but the demon doesn't. And Jesus follows it up with words saying, everything is possible for him who believes, or him who has faith. And we know that faith is basically the same as trust. And so Jesus seems to be suggesting here that you thought you guys had it under control and you could do it yourself, but not everything's possible for he who has it under control and thinks he can do it himself. Instead, all things are possible for he who believes, who puts their trust specifically in Jesus. And they're relying not on Jesus at this point. They're relying on their own track record, their own skill, maybe their own charisma in the crowd. Everybody is looking to them, and they kind of forget about Jesus in that moment. They're no longer relying on him. So I want to show you guys a triangle of belief. Down in the bottom left-hand corner of the triangle, we're going to have the idea of the level of belief, or the strength of belief. All right, we all believe in things. Some of us believe strongly. Some of us believe just barely. Most of us are somewhere in the middle. There is an errant branch of Christianity that says if you just believe hard enough, God is obligated to heal you, rescue you, get you your job, whatever. It's the thermometer as it reaches to this point, you have believed enough, and now you can force God to do his thing. Okay, I believe that's total hooey. But we do have in our triangle, we've got this idea of a level of belief. And then in the bottom right-hand corner of the trial, we've got the subject. So if the level means how much, the subject is the what. What is it that you're believing? What is it you're hoping for? In this case, the man is hoping that Jesus can get rid of the demon that's torturing his son. That's the subject of his faith, of his belief. And then the third point up at the top is the object. It's the who. It's who is your faith in? If the what is what you want to have done, the who are you hoping will do it for you? Who is your faith in? So if we've got a level of faith, and we've got the subject of faith, what it is we want, and the object of faith, who it is that we hope can do it, which of those three do you think Jesus is going to be most concerned about? I think it's the object. I think it's the who. I think that Jesus, like when he tells us if you have the faith the size of a mustard seed, you can move mountains. I think he's saying the level is not that important. Right? And when he says all things are possible, He's saying the what is not the big deal. Dealing with this demon, solving world hunger, whatever it is, it's not too big. God can do it. I think the message of this passage for us is this. It's the who you're believing in that matters. The disciples, they were relying on themselves, and it didn't work. They should have been relying on Jesus, because the who is more important than the what or the how much. So let's go on and see how this plays out. 24. Immediately, the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe, help my unbelief." Now, I think this is beautiful. I think we could all just close our Bibles right now, walk out of here and say, all week, I'm going to practice this. I'm going to wake up in the morning and I'm going to say, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." And I think we would all grow in our faith because of that simple practice. This is beautiful. This is humility, but this is also boldness. This is a desperate father who says, "I've got this little bit of faith. Jesus, I believe that you can do this, but I recognize my faith is small, so please grow my faith. Help my unbelief." He recognizes that the belief that he has is ultimately a gift to him from God. And that's true of all of us, too. If any of us have faith in God, it's not because we are faithful. It's because God is faithful and has given us the gift of being able to believe in him. And so he says, "I've got a little bit of faith. Please help my unbelief." And Jesus, I believe, is thrilled with this. Verse 25, "And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, 'You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again.' And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, 'He is dead.' But Jesus took him by the hand, lifted him up, and he arose." This is where we wish somebody in the crowd had their phone out, taking a video of the situation, right? Because we would really like to see how this plays out. Is Jesus simply using his regular voice, "Mute and deaf spirit, get out of him, never come back"? Or is he getting all dramatic, "You mute and deaf spirits"? How did it play out? How long did it seize the boy before it came out? How strong was that last battle as the spirit is ripped away from the flesh that's been its home for so long? How many gasps went through the crowd? How many mothers pulled their kids away so that they wouldn't see what was going on? How many fathers leaned forward to see if he was really dead or not? And the crowd was convinced he was dead. They said, "What we just saw, nobody could survive that. The boy's dead." But Jesus walks over, raises him up, and sends him back into a restored, normal, I mean, except for the celebrity status now, normal life. Isn't that beautiful? I mean, Jesus didn't have to do this, but he took the time to do it. And he did it in a humble, personal way. Physically raising the boy up. He could have just said, "On your feet, boy. You're well now." But you know, he goes and gently lifts him up. What a party must have followed after this. The joy in the family. It's like getting a do-over, starting over. Verse 28, this is interesting. "And when he had entered the house," that's Jesus, "his disciples asked him privately, 'Why could we not cast it out?' And he said to them, 'This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer.'" Now, some ancient manuscripts will add "and fasting." So if depending on what translation of the Bible you're working off of, it may say "this kind can only be driven out through prayer," or it might say "by prayer and fasting." The truth is, none of us have an original copy of any of the writings in the Bible. They were written on material that has decayed over time. It's been copied a whole bunch of times because the originals decay. And so what we end up with is small variances like that. There are no big variances that change the message of the Bible, but there are small ones like that. Now, Jesus says to them, You couldn't cast the demon out because you didn't pray. This is why I think they were doing it under their own power. Because when you think you can handle it, you don't remember to pray. You pray when you feel like you can't handle it. You pray when you know that you can't overcome this obstacle, when you're feeling helpless, when you're feeling lost, when you're feeling outmatched. That's when you pray. But when you think you're on top of it, that you can do your job, you can address the situation, you can handle whatever, who prays then? Nobody prays then, right? So Jesus is saying, look, guys, you are not the source of power and authority here. I am. As you're connected with me, that's the way you're able to do things. So don't get so full of yourself that you forget to pray. Now, he doesn't scold them, doesn't smack them on the head. He simply teaches them, okay, we're off the mountain, we're in the valley, we're confronting evil, don't forget to pray. Rely on me. I think that would be the lesson for us today too. So I ask you, where are you in the story? Are you one of the disciples? One of the disciples down with the crowd? Were you feeling like you could handle it? Are you generally a self-assured person? Like at work, if you are given a new task, you just assume you're going to be able to handle it and you're going to be successful and you're going to get the Employee of the Month award? Whatever the challenge, you're going to rise to it and do it. Maybe you've made it through most of life that way. You're just good at stuff. Jesus would remind you, the things that really matter, you can't do it without him. You need to be dependent on him in prayer. Maybe you're like the boy. Maybe you need rescued. Maybe you are trapped, you are desperate, and there's nothing you can do. Like, he can't even be part of the conversation that's going on here. But you need Jesus to miraculously intervene in your life. Maybe you are trapped in sin and darkness and death, and you need him to rescue you. Maybe you're trapped in an addiction. Maybe you're trapped in some kind of cycle of abuse. Whatever it is, you're trapped, and you need somebody more powerful than you to reach in from the outside and pull you out. There is only one person worth asking to help you in that way, and that's Jesus. Maybe you're like the Father. Now, I know some of you in this room, you are like the Father, and you're bringing your child to Jesus, and you're saying, Jesus, please, I have been begging you for years. I am scared. If I'm honest, I'm angry with you. You're not showing up. Can't you see my child is suffering in this way? Maybe it's a physical suffering. Maybe it's a social suffering at school. Whatever it is, but God, please show up. I can't do anything. The doctors can't do anything. The teachers can't do anything. And God, it seems like you're not doing anything either. God works in ways that we cannot understand and in timelines that we cannot understand. And just because he intervened in this particular way with this boy 2,000 years ago, it doesn't mean that he'll do the same or even a similar thing with us. He is the sovereign king of the universe and can do whatever he wants whenever he wants to do it. And sometimes, from our perspective, that really stinks. Because if we were the sovereign king of the universe, things would be different right now, right? This situation would be better. But I, for one, am thankful that I am not the sovereign king of the universe, because I can only see a little bit of what's going on. And if I were to fix the thing that I want fixed right now, I would mess up all kinds of other things too. Jesus is faithful and good even when you're down in the valley, even when you've been in the valley for years and years and years. He loves you. He cares for you. He hurts when you hurt. And even when it seems like he's saying, no, I'm not going to intervene in this situation, he is still with you, and he's still faithful. I know some of you, you're thinking, it's easy for you to say. But if you were in my shoes, it wouldn't be so easy to say. I understand. And I don't know the pain. I don't know the years of desperation. But Jesus does. And he is completely faithful. I mentioned a verse earlier when talking about the evil one. It's John 10:10. It says this: the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. But Jesus goes on. He says, I come that they may have life and have it abundantly. Not just a measly little life, but an abundant, full of God life. That's what Jesus says he has come for, to give to us. And we think, that's an awesome, awesome picture. But then look at the next verse, where he tells us how that abundant life comes to us. He says, I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep. So if you're in the valley and you're wondering why God isn't showing up, be reminded today, Jesus came as the good shepherd. And as the good shepherd, in the valley of darkness in this world, he gave up his life. He laid it down for the sake of his sheep, for us. That is how much he loves you. And when he's not fixing things the way you want them fixed, remember, he was addressing the much bigger problem of our sin when we didn't even care about it. As the good shepherd, he gave up his life for us.